January 19th, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for HBSTR. This week, last weekend I had a big snowfall here, and so I spent 3 days shoveling out snow out of my driveway. So I didn't get a lot of radio stuff done, but it looked nice, and I got a good workout. Next on the list, we have Greg, ZL3IX. Sean is mic muted. And then we have Henry, PA0HJA, Sean is recording and away. And then we have Mike, AAAK, Sean is recording and mic muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to teamspeakarchive.openhpsdr.org. Then we have Phil, VK6PH. Go ahead, Phil.
Thanks, Dave. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening all. Very productive week this week. I've been doing some more work on the envelope tracking, envelope elimination restoration code for the new types of linear amplifiers folks are working on. And I've got some code working, which has been tested by the development group, which is great, but it only supported EER and ET amplifiers. It didn't support general amplifiers with pure signal. So I've been working on modifying the code so that it'll work on in either mode, either conventional mode or envelope tracking, envelope elimination restoration mode, and just got it working. I just loaded the code into the Hermes board and all works fine. So I'll be shipping that out to the development team today. And I hope that's working okay. If so, I'll pop it up into GitHub during the week. Also, there's been a couple of, one part in particular that's gone end of life on the Orion boards, and the new part has been tested and fitted and did a little adjustment to the FPGA code, which I've done, but fortunately it's fully backward compatible to the existing code, so no major issues, and I'm just waiting to hear from Abby that code worked okay. Up for a very, very hot week. I think we're up for 40 degrees the next few days, so I'll probably be doing a bit of reading rather than working in the shack. A couple of questions for you, but we'll leave that for general topic, Dave. Back to you.
Fine business. And I did see a news article about the heat wave that Australia was experiencing. Next on the list is Bill, KD5TFD. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, got the right button there. Yeah, nothing here to report. Sort of heads down all week with sort of extra level of grudge work, drudge work with work this week. So can't have done anything interesting at all to talk about. So I'll turn it all back to you guys. All the EER work sounds interesting.
Well, yes, that does sound interesting. And then the last person on the list is Bob, the E3GKM, shown as a recording and away. So that brings us to general discussion.
Yeah, the progress with EAR is very exciting. The efficiency levels the guys are getting in the 500 to a kilowatt range is absolutely amazing. So very exciting progress there. Dave, I've got a problem. I can't find the latest Protocol 1 programmers. I'm opening on GitHub/TIFTAPO. I can see the OpenHBSDR Protocol 1 programmers, but in there all I can find is the source code. I can't find the XE. Could you have a look at that for me, please?
I will go and look, and I do have them here if they're not on the... It could have been that they got overwritten or somehow outlined, but I'll go give it a look.
Okay, it's no problem. I normally use the during development. I normally use the bootloader mode anyway because you're never sure whether in the development code the regular processes are going to work. So it's not been the problem of the bootloader I've got. It's okay, but I just wanted to test the standard procedure for doing it, and for some reason the I don't know what the file's called now. No, it says no V2 no. What is it? Just a second. Yeah, it says underscore version 2, no PCAP, but everything appears to be on the PC, but when I run it, it just nothing happens. So I've got to either Windows or Windows 10s change something on the PC, but it actually won't run. So, well, I couldn't find the executable on the in GitHub. So, appreciate if you wouldn't mind having a look for me.
Are you? Wait, you have PCAP on your machine because that has to be downloaded separately because of the PCAP license.
I'd imagine so. I think the bootloader requires PCAP from memory, unless John was able to embed it. But there's no error message anyway. It comes up. I thought there'd been an error message it didn't load, but I'll check that now, Dave.
Well, that's one issue. There is a. Have you checked under? So if you go GitHub Tapper, OpenHPR SDR Protocol 1 Programmers, the MSI version is there on the GitHub, and this is under the release directory.
Okay, so where am I? I'm looking at. Okay, let me just go back one. So I'm on github.com/tapper. And go on, yeah.
And then go to openhpsdr-protocol1-programmers.
Yep, I'm there.
And at the top of the page in the middle, there should be releases. You click on that, and in that should be executable files for download.
Okay, excuse this GitHub novice. Yeah, got it. Sorry, Dave, I missed that. I missed that little trick about clicking on releases. My apologies.
That's the link. And in there is the programmer plane, and then there is a version that is no PCAP.
Okay, that was the one I was running. Let me just... okay, I'll give it a go. Thanks very much, Dave. And where is your web-based programmer, please?
Just a minute, and I'll find it. It appears that I didn't ever post the HPSDR Protocol 1 web programmer, but I do have it, and I'll put that up.
Okay, thanks, Lee. Your mic's a bit loud. Perhaps just back off the mic gain a bit, Dave.
Yeah, it's an artifact of last week not working at all. I was fiddling with things.
Okay, thanks.
So just feedback from the other places, is it okay now?
I'm just downloading. Just one moment.
Oh, I mean for Bill and Mike.
You might come off a little bit.
Now I'm at 65%.
Yeah, it's still a little, it's sounding a little distorted on the peaks, but I mean better than it had been.
Yeah, I had it up high at about 90, and I had it up close to my mouth as well.
Yeah, I might have been doing it. It sounds pretty much right now.
Yep. It teaches you to fiddle with your settings with another program. It's amazing how different programs can't share settings very well.
No, sound card settings are just a complete mess. Actually, well... Linux and Windows both screw them up, but in completely different ways.
Say, Bill, thanks for the help last week, and I got everything working. But the one thing that was really helpful was to have both of my different accounts open at the same time. So I had the Open HPSDR account and my own account, and I made sure settings were the same and directories and everything looked the same, and that did the trick.
Yes, the joys of A-B testing. I take it turned out to be the permissions or some variant of that.
I think it was. It was that, and one directory was missing.
Okay, yeah, the permissions is a common gotcha on getting that set up.
But Dave, that's HPSDR program's running fine now, thank you.
Good, good. And I need to find the code to refer you to the web programmer for Protocol 1.
Okay, thank you. Now, you're doing one, you're developing one which does either Protocol 1 or Protocol 2, is that right?
Well, I was working on that. I got sidetracked. The problem that I was having is it will discover both protocol 1 and 2 fine, but then I have to build a selected rate. So what I do is I open up the all NICs. I loop through all NICs, and then I loop through all radios, or I look for any radio on each NIC, and then I have a list of radios, and I need to save that in a database or in a structure so that then you can tell me which radio you want to program, and then I don't have to do that discovery stuff anymore. And the way I was doing it, when I was working with just one radio at a time, the double discovery didn't make any difference, but it causes a bunch of problems when you have three or four radios, and I have to clean that out.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Understood. Yeah, that's working. Just checking it. Can find my Hermes board okay, and look for the file and everything. That's great. Thank you very much.
It's kind of fun. When I was trying the test of that code, I had Scotty's radio, which is Hermes Protocol 1, and then I had my Hermes board, and it was good at finding both and correctly identifying them.
Looks like we still have to have everything, every RBF file prefixed with Hermes, though.
Well, the programmers I had to have a name in the RBF that was equivalent to what you were trying to program. And that I know Joe always hated that and wanted me to get rid of it, but it avoids the situation where you might put Metis code into a Hermes board and then not know what's going on.
Yeah, no, understood. Oh, it's just during development, it's only a few seconds to change it. That's okay. No, I think that's probably a very good idea for the masses, Dave. Just on the side, I've been following on from the Christmas break. I managed to do some antenna work, and I do suffer from a bit of power line interference. But with the diversity reception available on our boards, I can go with a separate antenna, which is the low dipole, which I put up just to pick up the power line noise, and then can subtract that noise from the main signal without distracting from the wanted signal, and cancel out the power line noise, which is very effective. But it was only had a sent the dipole up for one particular band. I wanted to try it from some others, so I tried a beverage for 20 meters and above, but whilst that works okay, it didn't pick up enough power line noise, so I decided to build one of the little e-probes, which is just a high impedance amplifier with a very short whip in front of it, and that picks up about exactly the same amount of noise as the beam does, but the signals it picks up are nowhere near as strong as the beam, so that worked quite well. But interesting, I haven't played with e-probes before, and at least what I've built will work from a few tens of kilohertz up to 50-odd megs. So interesting to be able to just use it on any of the bands.
I'm surprised I would have thought any random wire would pick up the power line noise fairly well, I would think.
It's in one particular direction, and it's only about an S point or maybe an S point and a half above the band noise build. So it's not particularly strong. It's just very annoying because most of the signals I work into Europe are sitting just about, you know, this time of the sunspot cycle, most people are sitting fairly at the noise level. So having power line noise just above it. So I actually need quite a sensitive antenna. And if you put two good antenna up, then when you do the nulling, because the noise actually comes in the direction of Europe, which I'm mainly operating to, then you end up degrading not only nulling the power line noise, but getting rid of the signal you want as well. So, it took a bit of... I think if you had like 20 over 9 power line noise, which I've had in the past, then, you know, you can stick anything you like up to cancel it. But when it's very small, then you need an antenna which is reasonably sensitive, but not to the power line noise, but not particularly sensitive to the wanted signals.
Oh, I see.
But it was fun. I tried feeding the E-probe with coax, and as people report, picking up signal on the outer of the coax and having to choke it all off is quite a problem. I've got a fairly long run of coax out to the E-probe. I mounted it as far away in the corner of the block as I could, away from our house and any of the neighbours. So I ended up running Cat5 to it and using one pair balanced for the signal, and then one of the other pairs to run the power to it. And interesting, if I don't have the power on and plug the cable in, there's no increase in band in receiver front end noise whatsoever. So the balance in the Cat5 cable suppressing local pickup is very, very good.
Oh, I see.
The only I'll be doing is there's a lot of remote accessible SDRs around the world now, and sometimes there's particularly at the moment there's very little on the 20 meters in the evenings here. You work a few stations into Europe, but they've got like, you know, 6 over 6 over 6 beams at a couple of hundred feet, and you can work them, but there's not much else on. So having a listen around 20 meters on some of the SDRs around Europe is quite interesting to see, you know, what signals other people are hearing locally, and also listening to yourself. There have been a couple of occasions where the band's been open quite well into Europe, so I've connected to one of the SDRs in the UK and just had a listen to my signal being received, which is fun.
How much of an echo do you get on, from you talk till it bounces back through the SDR over the internet back to you?
It depends on the sites. Some of the SDRs, the latency in tuning is absolutely, you know, terrible. But others are actually quite quick. But there's one I use in the name in Farnham in the UK, which, I can use the scroll wheel on the mouse as if it was local. But there's others, University of Tweedy, is it, which is, you know, can head up to 300 people at once on there. Then the latency there is very, very high. You've got to picky an SDR with a few other users on it seems to be the trick. And on the menus, when you log into the web page, you can actually see how many people are connected to the each SDR.
Yeah, no, I wasn't really thinking about the latency and tuning. It was more just the, you know, once you've got it tuned, it's, because you've got propagation from you to the radio's processing time, and then the transit time back on the internet.
I haven't actually measured it, but it's very, very noticeable.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it is, man. I bet it's probably on the order of half second to a second, I would guess.
What is interesting is that because of the way my antenna's built, I can tune the antenna remotely, and I normally do is switch it 180 degrees away from the direction I'm firing, and then adjust the amplitude and phase of the currents into the loops to null the wanted signal and then switch it back. And that's theoretically the maximum forward gain. But it's useful to be able to actually just fine-tune amplitude and phase while you're, you know, listening to where you're being received and see what effect it has on the received signal. It's interesting, the tuning the reflector, or tuning one of the elements as a reflector, once you've tuned it below the frequency you're transmitting on, there's very little difference in forward signal. But if you start tuning it as a director, although because of the coupling, I've got capacitive coupling between the two elements, you can't convert a reflector into a director and, you know, effectively change the direction of fire. But the drop in the forward gain is very, very noticeable.
That's interesting.
The other thing is interesting, there's quite a few, particularly in the UK, there's quite a few people got SDRs where you can select, well, not a few, there's one I know in particular who's got a number of different receiving antennas, well-known makes and models, and you can switch between them and listen to the band on the different antennas to see how they perform, which was quite good because it was a couple of loops, ones I was looking at. One's called a loop on the ground, which is basically exactly what it says. It's a square, or one was a triangle loop, actually resting on the lawn. That worked about as well as a dipole. The signal loss is very high, but because of the sensitivity of the ANN and the HPSDR, that wasn't a problem. I still could hear band noise on 20 meters, but the difference in how the antennas perform was very interesting. Now, you can actually switch the antennas live while you're listening to a station, and I could also listen to the station here at the same time. The other thing was interesting, quite a few of the SDRs are in very, receive only of course, and very rural locations. And the difference in band noise in the away from built up areas and the signal noise ratio difference is quite interesting. It makes me think I maybe need a remote receiving site here for my and some of my friends' reception.
Yeah, wonder how you end up doing the backhaul for the remote site though, because it's truly remote. The backhaul is going to be hard.
Yeah, do it on 70 sims or something.
Oh, that's so
analog.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. I saw an interesting presentation this week on somebody trying to do this. Is actually not somebody from the ham community. It was somebody from the Internet of Things community talking about doing EMCOM with embedded devices where they're bundling, Wi-Fi and then the LoRa stuff, and trying to go that way and saying, made a comment that really bugged me a bit in that, the LoRa does, long distance better because it's at, 900 megahertz and it penetrates better. And I said, well, that may be true, but that's not why it's got better distance.
Well, and it also is using chirp technology.
Yeah, there's a double-digit dB of gain in the chirpage. So, I mean, that's where the primary thing comes from it. And somebody suggested, I gotta go look at this. You've seen the crank-up weather radios, and they're saying, well, why don't you run one of these things with, a little crank-up system? And I was thinking, well, I don't know that the crank-up systems transmit, and I bet the power usage for transmitting is an order of magnitude worse than the power usage for receiving. So in the LoRa stuff you've done, Phil, you done anything with Things Network?
Sorry, Bill, with which network?
I think it's called the Things Network.
No, I haven't, no.
I'm just exploring that stuff, and it was fascinating. There was a guy who apparently LoRaWAN protocols are all well published, but the LoRaPHY was not, and there was a fellow who reverse engineered to figure out what the signal was and how it encoded things, and it's a fascinating video on the web if you're interested in that kind of stuff. And I did find a group that's using LoRa on 70 centimeters.
The LoRaPHY talk was 2 or 3 years ago, maybe?
Yeah, 2015, and it was a guy named Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. I think it was Knight. It could have had a mic on front of it, but I can't remember. And I think his name was Matthew.
Yeah, I remember that talk. Somehow I ended up with that talk on the podcast player in my car, and I was listening to it on a long trip, and I was always saying I got to go back and look at the charts on this thing because the reverse engineering of it was quite neat.
Yeah, I guess he was kind of like Mike Osman, where he's interested in security, and he's because of the breaks and other protocols in the PHY, he wanted to know what the PHY was like on that. And he found some signals. This was early on when LoRa was just coming out, and basically tried to figure out how everything worked. And then he got finally a transmitter and put things in and figured out what came out and was able to decode it.
Yep. So in terms of doing lowered down at 433. I think that was the protocol one of the presenters at the DCC was where he was going for a distance record, New Mexico, for UHF, was using that.
Yes, yes, I saw that. And I saw that for LoRa, Australia and the U.S. use their normal frequency is 915.
It's funny, the neighborhood I live in, we have a creek through the neighborhood, which is a bit of a problem, and it's becoming more of a problem with all of the building and its tending to flood more. So they have upstream, there are stream gauges on it, and you can... I was in a meeting this week where they said, you know, where the stream gauges were. And I said, oh, is that the one with the antenna down there on that bridge there? They said, yes, you can get all the data from the internet. And I said, does anybody know the radio protocol for that? I'd really like to, like, receive it directly.
Yeah, most people wouldn't think the way you do, Bill.
Yeah, the presenter looked at me like I was truly out of my mind.
Probably you get the same looks when you talk to the electric company that you like to receive the meter data directly.
No, actually, I've got that one. That one I've got resolved. In Texas, if you have a smart meter, it has to have the capability for a what they call a home area network device to get it. And it's a Zigbee network, and it's rather annoying in that it's all secured. It's got to be provisioned in the back end to talk to you. You have to call them up or go to the website and put in the MAC address and the authentication parts of your gizmo, and then they have to add it in the back end. And invariably, this seems to involve a call or two with people in India, but it does work fairly well, and I find it amusing. But I think I'm one of the, like, three people in Texas that have this setup.
Well, if you have somebody who's a ham and an experimenter, it's likely they'd like to try this.
Yeah, well, that one, there's so much consternation about privacy and the like that they went really quite overboard. But it is sort of interesting, though, to scope out the infrastructure in the neighborhood, because I noticed pictures of what I can only describe as boxes sitting on... the top of light poles with antennas pointing down, you know, omni antennas, but they're mounted on the bottom instead of the top, apparently, to here. And I actually went out and took a picture of one of them with a long lens to be able to read the labels on the box in the air, and see that it's a it's the telemetry for the meters in the neighborhood and stuff like that. But hard to find any, published information or much published information. But I guess the water meters here now also are radio readable, and I'd like to figure out how to get those.
Well, I did find a box like that in our neighborhood, which is it was basically a black box bolted to a light pole and had two antennas pointing down, and they looked, a little shorter than what a quarter wave 2 meter antenna would be.
Yeah, these are not. These are actually mounted out on the streetlight part, and the streetlight arm pushes out, and these are mounted on the streetlight arm, and they're down, and they're probably, I'd say the antennas are maybe 18 inches with a couple little twists in them. I took some pictures of them. I have to go see if I have the pictures posted on the web. But I did go looking around on the various meter vendor sites and saw pictures of these things. And then also in the neighborhood, I see a we've got a couple of places where they've got phone poles that are twice as high as the rest of them. And on the top of it, they've got two antennas on either side. And they're like fiberglass radome antennas. And they're, a foot out on each side on the top of the pole, and those, I think, are some sort of backhaul, although they're omni, so I don't quite know what they are. But I also saw pictures similar to that on some of the vendor websites, so I mean, that's my methodology for figuring out what the hell the infrastructure is out there.
Well, we have not the kind of poles you're talking about, but fiberglass poles with these kind of lantern light boxes at the top, and this box was bolted just below the light box, and with like hose clamps, and then it had two antennas pointing down out of the bottom of the box.
No, okay. I'll have to go go figure that out. But, yeah, I don't know. Ever since I got licensed, I can't seem to not see an antenna now. And the one that's intriguing me now is all through town we have cameras at intersections on traffic lights with and usually at the intersections you'll have a vertical omni antenna in the intersection, but then you'll also have a what looks like a patch antenna, you know, which has got some directionality to it. And I've noticed that they point, you know, in various places, or, you know, they point away from the intersection and stuff like that. And I, one of these days, I have a meeting to go inventory where the hell do these things point to and what's there.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
I think one of these days I'd like to write a open information request and say, okay, guys, where's the camera feeds? And please, how long do you keep the data and where can I get it? So, Phil, does Australia ever shut down its government from time to time?
No, we just change prime ministers.
It's rather. I'm positively amazed that they're still running airports. I cannot understand why people are showing up to work without getting paid.
I had some friends that are furloughed, and I said, why don't they just, if people have to work, deficit spend till something gets resolved? And they said up to about 20 or 30 years ago, that's the way the U.S. government worked, is if they didn't pass a budget, they just deficit spended on their old budget until the thing was over, and then they resolved the differences. But apparently they decided one time about 15, 20, or 20 or 25 years ago that you couldn't spend money without a approved budget.
Yeah, well, I think that's sort of in the Constitution, actually.
But it does seem silly to ask somebody to work when they are unable to pay.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's almost a basic intelligence test. I mean, particularly if it's a lower wage job. But I'm amazed that they say, well, you know, well, we have to have, you know, the IRS employees come in with, you know, no pay to, you know, process tax return or tax refunds. I'm like, yeah, that just seems, that doesn't seem like an essential, you know, life or death service. But I don't know, interesting times.
Yeah, I think if somehow the airlines got disrupted, there would be some action fairly quickly.
You would think. So are you doing any lower WAN stuff with your stuff, Dave? Or?
I have a variety of little boards to test, and I'm learning about what each one does and writing little test programs to figure them out. And but I haven't made a whole lot of progress.
Yeah, I'm still, I find these things intriguing, but I have no direct application or need to figure them out, so I just sort of look at them. They're like tech porn or something.
Well, I have the situation where, with a work project that, I collect data in a place where there is no internet and no cell phone, and but I like using interconnected devices to collect data. So the idea being that you would set some kind of a computer in a vehicle within a mile of where you actually are and send data back from your collection site. And then it's all based there. And then when the vehicle got back to the office, you could download it there, or it could, when it got to a place where there was cell or internet service, you could download it.
I see. I guess, well, so you don't need the data right back right away, you just need it back eventually.
Yeah, you're collecting it, and forestry. We work in places that are often not very well covered by cell phones. because just the density of people is so low. And but you know, in some parts of the country, a lot of the East Coast, they're pretty much all the forests are covered by cell phones. And here, or in some places in the West, and you know, big parts of Texas, you can't get a whole lot of cell service unless you get one of the balloons.
Yeah, that's actually gotten a lot. I was amazed in my drive out to Albuquerque how good the cell coverage was. I mean, it wasn't until I was really way the hell out there in the middle of nowhere in Albuquerque, out by or New Mexico, by the very large array, where that you started to. Well, you didn't have any cell coverage out there, but I was amazed how good the coverage was. I think it's getting better, but I'm sure there's still places. But how often do you need the data back? Or, you know, could you? It almost sounds like a good excuse to, like, go fly a plane over your collection area and collect your data.
Well, yes, I've thought about that. And the what I'm interested in is if you could get a large number of individuals collecting data all at the same time, you could complete the data collection tasks in a more efficient way, or actually double sample, because everybody measures things and they believe their one measurement is absolutely correct with no error, which is almost never true. It can be high quality or low quality, but you have no idea of knowing the situation unless you take multiple samples.
Yeah, understood. Well, sounds like an interesting project.
It's my statistical side coming out. So, Phil, does it get fairly warm in your ham shack in this time of year?
Yeah, it does. It's only a single brick dwelling, so it does warm up. It's got, you know, it's insulated roof and blinds over the ceilings, but just the, when it's hot enough for long enough, the walls heat up. But it's not, it's, during the week it's not too bad, because, you know, when I'm at home in the evenings, there's formerly the windows face the ocean, so just a matter of opening the windows and let the sea breeze in, so it's not too bad. But during the day, it's can get a bit warm. But I've now got remote access to my PC here and et cetera from inside the house, so I can keep working now.
Well, that's good.
Do you have the other problem in the winter with it getting too cold? Or
doesn't get cold here in the winter, Bill.
Not ever?
Oh, yeah, but, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, but, you know. Wake time, it's not cold, no.
Really? Okay. So you don't get any, you know, 2 or 3 day snaps of, you know, below freezing temperatures?
No, I don't ever remember it. I think the lowest temperature I can remember is about 3 degrees.
Oh.
That's Celsius.
Well, I remember Phil talking about going to Korea, and he saw snow for the first time in many years.
I also went to Qatar a few weeks ago, and it rained for the first time in 10 years. It was the day I arrived, and the my host was picking me up from the airport, and nobody turned up, and they SMS'd me and said, sorry, you know, the roads are flooded, and oh, that's okay. But it hadn't rained for 10 years, and because it rained so infrequently, there was no drainage in the roads. So it was literally up to the axles of the cars, a lot of cars abandoned. And because there's no drainage, the rain, you know, the water stays in the roads for days.
That is unusual.
Also, the front, I get up in the next morning and the front, they said, please exit the lift on rather than the ground floor, on the first floor, and use the stairs. And I found out why. The rain had come through the ceiling in the reception area of the hotel, and it was completely flooded.
I guess if there was no rain for that long of time, there is no mechanism for collecting rainwater either.
That's right. There's none.
Do they operate mostly off of desalinization or groundwater?
Desalinization. The other thing that interested me was I would have thought that, you know, because of the amount of sunlight, that be using lots and lots of solar panels. But that's not the case. And the issue is the amount of sand dust in the air, you know, deposits itself on the surface of the solar panels, and they'd have to be, you know, have some perpetual mechanism to try and keep them clean.
Yeah, I would assume that that would be a never-ending task.
I have the same problem here. My panels face the ocean, and if you don't clean them, you know, every few months, then the salt build-up on the front sticks the dust on there, and the efficiency drops off very, very rapidly.
Oh, that's interesting.
The other thing is the solar panels don't work well. At least mine's probably about 8 years old now, but in the models I have, it may not be so correct now, but the efficiency drops dramatically in hot weather.
Is that the circuitry overheats?
I think it's a function of the type of solar cell being used.
I would bet that's the physics of the semiconductor, probably.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. And, you know, the panels I've got are fairly old now, so I'm sure the technology's changed multiple times since then. But it's certainly very noticeable. You get maybe a 25-degree day, and you get a lot more output than when it's 36 or so degrees, even though there's, you know, obviously appears to be a lot more sun.
Well, that's where you need a hybrid system where you're going to take some of that heat away from the solar panels and heat hot water.
I've already got one of those. But a separate solar-powered hot water system.
No, you need an integrated, unified solution there.
I use it to heat the swimming pool, you mean?
Actually, one of my neighbors put a whole series of panels up on his roof. I was like, what the hell is he doing? And he gets an extra month or three of the pool use with heating the pool water up in the sun on the roof.
That's interesting. When I went to had a trip to Dubai about a month ago, and my morning exercise is to have a swim. So I got up fairly early, had a swim, and went to get into the pool. And the pool was absolutely freezing. And it's the reverse there. They actually chill the water because of the high air temperature. The water gets too hot.
Yeah. Well, I'm really familiar with that problem because here, my pool in August will get it'll be in the 90. You know, if I get to run a hot days, it'll get to 92, 93.
Yeah, I just wasn't not used to that. So. Okay, guys, I've got to run. So my X-ray looks like she's a right clone, so I'm going to start the chores today. 73 is all. Good to chat, and catch you next week.
73,
Phil.
User disconnected from your channel.
Well, I'll have to get some pictures of my various utility antennas seen around town posted, and maybe I'll bring that to show and tell next week, and maybe I'll get some leads on what the hell they actually are.
Well, I've been, based on your encouragement, noticing old microwave sites in our area, so I found one or two around here, based on that map you posted one time.
Oh, yeah, you know, that's... There are actually chains of those that were built after those maps, and I'll have to find you the link. I don't have it handy now, but there is somebody put up a Google site. I was amazed because out here, 100 to 150 miles west of here, there's a line of towers I didn't know was out there at all, which I have to go visit one of these days. So I'll have to dig that link and post it over to you one of these days.
Well, it is fun, and I'm interested in all kinds of different kinds of technologies. So it's one of those things that it's kind of like the Brits. They love to train spot and airplane spot and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, for me, it's sort of infrastructure. Although the tower, the microwave towers, that whole system is amazing because it went from, you know, it came out, they built it after World War II, and... I think it was probably obsolete in probably the 90s when they, started cutting everything over to fiber. So, I mean, it was an incredible amount of capital. I'd love to know what they spent on it. And it, you know, only had a lifetime of about 40, maybe 50 years, which to me seems like an awful short lifetime. But it's also really interesting to read. The Bell System guys were really good on documenting the Bell System Technical Journal stuff, and I have a series of books from them, and history of engineering the Bell System, and the write-ups on these systems are, I mean, it's amazing to see, you know, these things were analog and they were, you know, the transmitters were a few watts and things like that. And, you know, it's pretty amazing what they did with the technology they had.
Sure is. I, over Thanksgiving and Christmas, I read a book on, it was set up to talk about Sarnoff mostly, but it talked a lot about Armstrong, and then it talked about Sarnoff in his early days worked for the Marconi Company and actually was around when the Titanic sunk, and then he went out with Armstrong to their huge antenna, and they hooked up Armstrong's Heterodyne radio, and it was like it went from they didn't hear anything to they could hear everybody all at once. And it was a real interesting little look at history. And thinking about it, it was the, you know, basically the time of World War One or shortly thereafter that all that was. And that, in some senses, that isn't that long ago.
No. Do you know what the book was?
I can send you the citation. It's a guy named Woolsey, Scott Woolsey, I think, wrote it.
Okay, I'd be interested to see. Have you ever seen the PBS video Empire of the Air?
I have not. Is that anywhere where you can find it?
I would bet you could get it from Netflix or Amazon. I mean, well, you can buy it from Amazon for $12 as a DVD. It's very much worth seeing. I was fascinated by it when the time I've watched it.
You know, the other thing, Mike sent us a link, I think it was Mike, a link to a podcast with Frank Brickle. And he talked about, the interviewer asked him about which of those two influenced him the most, and he seemed to favor Armstrong. And he said but he wasn't far from those Marconi towers where Brickle grew up.
Yeah, no doubt. There's actually Armstrong had a, let me find a picture of it. Armstrong had a very famous tower, which actually it's still there today. I was amazed though when I figured out what it was, because I had seen this thing as a kid over and over again, because it was fairly close to where I live, and you know we would you'd see it on the highway. And but yeah, the Empire of the Air is definitely worth listening or watching. And I do remember the podcast with Frank Brickle. That was a good listen as well.